Around South Zurich. Welcome to this podcast linked to the exhibition Earth Beats, The Changing Face of Nature, curated by Sandra Gianfreda and Catherine Hook. In 12 episodes, you will hear, among others, ecofeminists, writers, glaciologists, fashion designers, and economists who take us right into the middle of a highly topical debate about climate and the environment. My name is Sandra Gianfreda, and in this episode I am talking with Jeremy Narby. He is an anthropologist who spent some time with an indigenous people, the Ashaninka, in the Peruvian Amazon. He is the author of The Cosmic Serpent, DNA and the Origins of Knowledge, published in 1997, and of Intelligence in Nature, An Inquiry into Knowledge, published in 2005. So, for centuries, intelligence in Western science has long been considered a purely human quality, a quality that requires a brain. Now, recent research has shown that even bees with a tiny brain can abstract, or that even single-celled organisms can take decisions. How would you define intelligence in nature?
Well, when we try to talk about plants or even the animals, living beings other than ourselves, it's important to understand that the words we use, which are by definition human words, influence what we can think and how we think. And if ever there was a clear example of this, it's with the word intelligence. And so interlegere is Latin. So we're in Western languages, Latin languages. Interlegere is to choose between, etymologically. That's what the word means. But over the centuries during which Western thinkers speaking Latin languages have used this word, they have considered in a very Western fashion that intelligence was a human monopoly. And so intelligence was supposed to be one of the things that we had and all the others didn't have. And then, so what is this intelligence? And it turns out that now, what is it, 300 or 400 years later, there are 70 different definitions of intelligence that have ended up in dictionaries. And almost exclusively in human terms. This means that by definition, intelligence is very difficult to apply to other species. And the more different these species are from humans, the more this is true. And so there are some very clear examples of this in the recent history of science. For example, when a Japanese researcher showed that a single-celled slime mold could negotiate a maze, a labyrinth, when he published his results in the journal Nature, he used the word intelligence. The Western journalists mainly questioned using the word intelligence for a slime mold. The Japanese reporters that got in touch with him wanted to know how such an organism could solve the maze. In other words, the Western observers couldn't even start to think about what the slime mold was doing in a maze. In Japanese, it should be said that the concept for intelligence, so if you look in the English-Japanese dictionary under intelligence, it'll say in Japanese, chi-sei. Chi-sei is capacity to know. The Japanese, coming from an animist Shintoist culture, have never had a doubt that all living beings have a capacity to know. What I'd like to say is that if we're going to talk about plants and their capacities, let's just say, and we have to look at every single word we use, it's important to see that plants are like us because they are organisms made of cells and DNA, and they're part of this evolutionary biospheric scenario that has generated us and them, so that we actually have biophysical kinship with them, just like with any other living organism. So we're part of the same family. But A plant is very different from an animal because it has no central nervous system. It has no organs. It's unspecialized. It mainly does not move, at least not like an animal. The whole point of an animal is that it's animate. And so when we as incarnated biological organisms in an animal form, we have brains, we have hearts, we have all these different organisms, we move around, we have our own time frame. And then we look at plants, and for a long time, at least in the Western world, they say, plants, they don't do anything, they don't move, you know, they're just things, they're green things. Okay, they grow very slowly, but all this is just normal physicochemical reactions. It happens by osmosis. These are processes that we now understand.
For us, it's like clear that animals of the same species communicate. That's a concept we can understand, but apparently plants do the same. And how do they do this if they don't have a language, a mouth to speak? And how can we learn to communicate with plants?
Here again, I think one has to start questioning the word language, if only because for a long time, humans thought that they were the only ones who had a language. So our understanding of what a language is extremely human-based. And plants obviously don't talk. So what has become apparent in only the last 30 years, maybe, that plants produce thousands of different chemicals, volatile organic chemicals, VOCs, which they emit above ground and that other plants perceive. And that, well, it's like having thousands of different words, but they're not words in a human language. They are substances. So plants speak in chemicals. Now, humans speak in chemicals a little bit, you know, pheromones. We don't even realize this, but we humans do emit smells, and these smells do contain information that others perceive. Another way that plants communicate is underground, also using chemicals or just charged atoms, ions. They use the mushroom networks. So there's all kinds of invisible, literally underground communication that has been demonstrated recently. And finally, plants also use electrical signals inside themselves to communicate with themselves. In other words, so they don't have brains, they don't have all these different organs, but when one part of the plant is damaged, for example, it will send electrical signals inside itself. And some of these signals are identical to the ones that our own brains use.
In your book, The Cosmic Serpent, you put forward the hypothesis that shamans take their consciousness down to the molecular level by the aid of a plant-based drug, that is ayahuasca, and gain access in their visions to information related to DNA. So there is communication between nature and humans on this molecular level. And could you elaborate on this concept?
Yes. One thing that plants do is produce substances that activate the brains of animals. Tobacco plants produce nicotine, and nicotine makes insects confused and even kills them if they eat too much of it. Nicotine is a substance that activates the neurons of animals, including humans. It's first and foremost a discombobulator of insects. So these plants that are psychoactive have been identified by indigenous cultures around the world as being interesting because they make us think in a new way. They make us see images, or hallucinate or have visions. So, for example, there's the ayahuasca vine in the Amazon. The indigenous cultures that have identified these different plants as being plants that lead us to new understandings, they consider that these plants are like persons, that the communication is deliberate, and that when you, if you want to interact with the plant and you want to learn from it, the way you go about it is you prepare your body and then you ingest this plant, and then you study the impact that the plant has on your body and on your mind. And so if one speaks with the experts in these cultures, and let's call them shamans to take a shortcut, about, well, what does one learn from the ayahuasca plant brew? One learns first and foremost about other plants. One learns about, it would seem that what this particular Amazonian vine likes to teach people is about the properties of other plants. But one also learns when in ayahuasca visions, it is quite common that people see how plants and animals are suffering because of people. Ayahuasca seems to be a conduit for allowing other species to voice their complaints to human beings. So these are some of the very common themes that one can find in shamanic traditions where people are deliberately ingesting plants and hoping to learn from them and gain an understanding of their point of view. All of this, it should be said, given that we are two Westerners speaking to each other in a Western language, flies in the face of much of what was thought possible not so long ago. You know, not so long ago, plants do not communicate. When you hallucinate taking a hallucinogenic plant, you are not receiving verifiable information from the plant. You are just hallucinating stuff. And that's all there is to it. That used to be the university-based point of view not so long ago. But now there has been considerable advances in the study of what goes on in the brains and minds of people who have ingested these substances, like ayahuasca with dimethyltryptamine, or the psilocybin mushrooms, and then putting people in brain imaging machines and looking at what is going on in the mind of such a person. And the scientists who do this will not tell you, oh, yes, the plant is communicating. They will tell you, oh, the brain is functioning in a more flexible way than it usually does, in a less filtered way. And so there's all kinds of new ideas and new perspectives that come out of it. And meanwhile, the indigenous cultures, they didn't need to know about the molecules and so on before moving forward into that other dimension or domain or whatever realm and exploring it and then bringing back reports as to, oh, well, in that other world, we see plants as if they were people. And each species is like a personality. And tobacco has such and such a personality. Ayahuasca has such and such. Each different plant has a different personality. Now, this once again is going to fly in the face of objectivist knowledge that says, no, personifying plants and animals is childish, it's irrational, it's animist, and it's false knowledge. Real knowledge is to objectify.
Yeah, we tend to see humans and nature on two different sides, and that's what we have to overcome and see humans as part of nature, and or as you said, as we are all part of one family. And what I think interesting is that you really try to put these two approaches together, so the indigenous knowledge and the Western science.
Yeah, well, let me try this, because I think that science and objective knowledge is good. And I think that, let's call it the indigenous approach to knowledge and the personification of other species is also good. And by good, I mean it yields solid knowledge that is usable and helps us understand things. So It is possible to look at me and to see an object. You can objectify me and say, I weigh 74 kilos, I'm made of flesh. If you take a knife and cut me, blood is going to come out. You know, there are verifiable things. My brain weighs about 1.4 kilos, I think, and so on. And at the same time, I think it's also clear that I am a person because, in other words, I'm not just a sack of flesh. I am a sack of flesh, but I'm not just a sack of flesh. I'm also a person. I perceive, I learn, I remember, I communicate, I have a point of view. Now, just what a person, what does it mean to be a person? Philosophers write books about this. One of the answers they give is, if you have a point of view, you are a person. So meanwhile, we get to indigenous people, and they don't make any difference between plants, animals, and humans. And on the contrary, they're saying they are people like us. We just don't see it. But when we when our eyes are prepared in shamanic states of consciousness, then you see it. Then you see the person inside the tree, inside the animal. And by identifying with these other species, by trying to imagine their point of view, I think that they get to solid knowledge. Amazonian people have very solid knowledge about jaguars and deer and trees and fish. And yes, obviously they observe them just like a scientist would and how they behave, but they also use their minds to try to imagine their point of view and their way of knowing the world. So by personifying what we call nature, they actually get to an understanding that is perfectly complementary to what an objectivist scientist might say about the same question.
Yeah. Well, so far, humans have only exploited nature, and we have never really given back something to nature. And now we have come to a point where we see it can't continue like this.
Well, I would just question the we in your sentence, because yes, Western humans historically have been like this for the last 1,000 years at least. But in many other parts of the world, especially in cultures, in animist cultures, but even in places like India and with the Hindu religion and so forth, there is this notion of making offers to the forces of nature, you know, and that it can't just be take, take, take. And there has to be some kind of reciprocity. The whole point about thinking that other species have a point of view, this is the first thing that one can do in trying to establish a relationship with other species, is to try to think about what their point of view might be. And actually, this is a complicated exercise. Just imagining what the point of view of a plant might be is philosophically fairly complex, and that they're not going to express them in English or in German. And so we've got to make an effort now to think about what that point of view might be.
The insights that you have gained from your research and your field work, have these insights changed the way you live? And if so, is there something you can share with us?
Yeah, sure. It's not stuff that's very spectacular. But for example, I love going for walks in the forest. I love gardening. I love being with plants. I wouldn't put a pesticide or an insecticide on anything where I live. You know, when I see birds, I say hello to them. You know, I try to think about the tree's point of view. You know, so this is it's pretty practical, down to earth stuff. I also spend most of my working time raising funds for indigenous Amazonian people so that they can protect their rainforest, demarcate and gain land titles to their rainforest, and also have bilingual intercultural education so that their culture that has all this knowledge about the rainforest and how to live with it, that these languages and cultures continue to exist. You know, I spend my waking hours and my whole professional life has been spent raising funds to back this kind of initiative. So I'm happy to be involved in that way. I think that it's made me by having these kinds of experiences where one is touched by plants, touched by other cultures, and one understands that, yes, they are living, yes, they are precious, yes, a lot of harm has been done to them. So it's a good idea to try to do something in solidarity with them. But, you know, I try to say that as humbly as possible, because one is only a small human being. One can only do so much. But yeah, so it has changed my life in that way.
Publisher, Zürcher Kunstgesellschaft, Kunsthaus Zürich. Idea and conception, Sandra Gianfreda and Catherine Hook. Editing and production, Christoph Keller, Podcast Lab. Production of the jingles, Markus Mäder. This podcast is on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Deezer and Audible. With many thanks to Rhiannon Ash, Esther Brown and Sarah Carla Nancy. With support of Swiss Re, partner of Contemporary Art, and Tarbaka Indigo Foundation. For this episode, the artist Markus Mäder recorded sounds from the Amazonian rainforest by night.